This is the Scarehouse Podcast. My name is Glenn Ritchie, a.k.a. Delirium Dog. I'm the sound designer for the Scarehouse. But I'm not here to talk to you about that today. I am guest hosting this episode because I have been sent by the Scarehouse on special assignment to New York City in order to cover the off-Broadway phenomenon that is Sleep No More. I just got back from a very interesting couple of visits to New York where I saw the show multiple times, had a chance to interview one of the performers in Sleep No More, Karina Melia, who plays Hecate the Witch in the show, and you will hear that interview in a little bit. And I also assembled a panel of Sleep No More experts, I call them experts, and recorded a wonderful conversation with them, and you will also hear that. But first, what is Sleep No More, and why are we talking about it in this podcast? Well, first of all, I should say at the outset that Sleep No More is not a haunted house. It may be a little creepy. It may be in a real place that you walk around, and there are live performers, but there are no big scares. There may be blood, but no guts. You know what I mean? Like, definitely no chainsaws, nothing you'd expect to find in a haunted house. So let's talk about what it is. It is a production of Shakespeare's Macbeth, set roughly in the 40s. It is mostly wordless. It incorporates characters and stylings from Hitchcock movies, mostly, which I'd say there's also a touch of David Lynch in there as well. But what really sets it apart is that it takes a place in a 100,000 square foot warehouse in the Chelsea neighborhood in New York, and guests are completely set loose in the space and encouraged to explore the gorgeously detailed sets. You can open drawers, read notes left behind by the characters, become completely immersed in this world. There are only two rules that they give you, which are guests are required to wear a white mask at all times, which makes you like an anonymous viewer of the show, and you are not allowed to speak. You are also encouraged to explore alone. As you are exploring, you see people in period clothing, so someone might walk by who's not wearing a mask, and those are the characters in the story, and you can choose to follow them and see how they interact with the set and with other characters. Sometimes they'll interact with you. When two or more characters part ways, you can choose which one to follow or not follow anyone and just explore the space, hang out, see what happens. Because there are many things happening at once, you can still attend the show multiple times and not see everything. I myself have now been to the show 10 times over the course of a year, and can say that each show has been a very different experience for me. So why are we talking about it in this podcast? Well, I also managed to coax several members of the Scarehouse staff to come all the way from Pittsburgh to attend the show, and they all loved it, and Scarehouse Scott, especially after seeing it a couple times, was so impressed that he wanted me to do an episode on it, and especially interview Karina, whose performance he found very impressive. And she is amazing in the show. And let me just say, if you have any interest in set design, lighting, sound design, costuming, movement, strong character-driven performance, the logistics of running a really complex show, I mean, all these things you often hear about in this podcast, then Sleep No More will definitely interest you. I did especially love the sound design, and I could do a whole show on the sound design alone, but I won't. Now, one important note before we continue is that this podcast will contain some light spoilers, and as it progresses towards the end, some medium to heavy spoilers. You can certainly search around the internet and find far worse spoilers, but don't. What I really do believe that you are best off first seeing the show without knowing anything. Yes, you will be confused. That's part of the fun. And you can never duplicate that experience of being bewildered and overwhelmed by all the strange stuff happening around you. It can only happen the first time. It still happens maybe even a little bit the second time. But all you need to know is before you go, before I send you out on your own, you want to wear comfortable shoes. You want to queue up early. You want to be prepared to be separated from your party. Don't worry, you can meet up afterwards and talk about it, which is a big part of the fun. And just go in with an open mind, knowing you will not understand everything. So right now, it is perfectly okay. You have my permission. If you decide to pause this episode and pick it up again once you've seen the show yourself, go ahead. Trust me, it's better that way. Okay? All right? All right, for those of you who are left, we will first hear a portion of my conversation with the Sleep No More expert panel, which will help set up my official interview with the wonderful and talented Karina Melia. And I should point out that this is an official interview, meaning that I went through the official channels to set it up. I didn't just pull her aside at the bar afterwards. The staff at Punk's Drunk Productions were very serious, professional, and courteous about the whole thing, which I greatly appreciate. And as far as I know, this is the only audio interview of its kind speaking to a performer at length. And I found it rather illuminating, so I hope you enjoy it. One more note, you will hear several URLs referenced along the way. I will collect all those links and post them on my blog, which you can find at deliriumdog.wordpress.com. Delirium is spelled D-E-L-I-R-I-U-M. So it's deliriumdog.wordpress.com. So you can go there now, click around as you listen. Wouldn't that be fun? Okay, so let's get to it. Let's journey to New York City and delve a little deeper into the world of Sleep No More. All right, we are now in the Lower East Side of Manhattan. And thanks to the Recession Art Gallery, Recession Art, I forgot the RAC. Anyway, thanks to them, we have a nice space here to talk in. Somewhat echoey, but we'll be nice and close to the mic, so that's okay. And I am surrounded by a panel of three hand-picked Sleep No More experts.
I eat the ones you found on Twitter.
No, hand-picked.
Hey, it's a tweet of sorts. It's a wonderful.
I stalked you extensively before.
Never use that word again,
out.
Evan.
So, without further ado, let me introduce you all. To my left, I have Catherine Yu, who is a blogger and a photographer.
Yes.
And we don't have to list all of your credits, but you blog a little about Sleep No More and other things.
Mm-hmm.
At?
What? my URL. It's just my name, Catherine Yu, KatherineYu.com.
Okay, and I'll put all these links together in one place, so don't you feel like you have to. So, and you've been to Sleep No More roughly?
I've been to Sleep No More 8 times, starting in the spring of last year.
Very good.
So, 2011.
Very good. And to her left is Allison Meyer, and you have a blog called...
It's Allé Allé, which is like, in French means go alley, because it used to be my... France travel blog, but now I post about New York a lot, and that's included Sleep No More. And I'm a writer for some different publications on the arts and travel in New York. Are we doing the thing where we say how many times we've
been? Yeah, how many times?
I've been 12 times, so. Mm-hmm.
When was your first time?
I feel like that was a...
not a leading
question. We're not getting that personal.
April of 2011.
Okay, so you and I probably started going around the same time.
Yeah.
But we've spaced our visits out.
Yeah, I mean, it's over a year, so that's not that many, right?
Right.
I've still surprisingly been to other things more because my obsessions are broad and intense. So, yeah.
But it's not over yet.
Jesus, I know.
Oh, and to her left is Evan Matthew Cobb.
Hi. I have a Sleep No More blog called Scorched the Snake. That's scorchedthesnake.tumblr.com.
A fairly exhaustive blog, I must say.
Exhaustive only in that it's just been around for almost a full year now. The idea of that blog is kind of as an aggregator to sort of help people have a sort of one-stop shopping experience for news about the show. I've been to see Sleep No More, as of last night's performance, 28 times. I've been going since opening night, so.
But we know you have not, you do not have the record by a long shot.
No, not even, which is a relief to me.
Do they know the record?
It's someone in excess of 70.
Oh my God.
Wow, that's.
Do you know who that?
That
is?
Was no, I don't, and that's the count as of about 2 months ago.
So is there some rogue person who's?
It's a very very devoted fan of the show who just loves to be there. I've never met the person.
You don't know if it's a man or a woman.
Nope, I believe it's a man, but I don't know anything else. I don't know a name. I don't know if this person has one of the other unattributed Sleep No More blogs out there. Maybe does, but
you gotta really admire. That
is a substantial commitment to a show
about it too. So we each had this moment where someone dragged us to the show, and I'll probably talk about mine before we do this. So, Catherine, you had your first moment.
So I found out about the show through Facebook, where a friend of mine who works at Time Out New York had posted a photograph of herself and her boyfriend just in their white masks, without really a description of where they had been or what they had done while they were there. She just said that to all of her friends, you must beg, borrow, steal money and make it to this production. So I started looking into it a little more and I thought, oh, well, this would be fun. So I bought 2 tickets for myself and my husband and came out completely confused but also converted. And I think part of it is I have more of an analytical background, I think. I've worked in web and software technology, so it turns on not just the art and photography and music appreciating parts of my mind, but also the more kind of operational part of my mind. Like, how did they do that? Where did she go? Where did that pile of sand in her hand come from? Wait, is that the same person I saw before but wearing a different costume? Yeah. What the heck? Like, how do they actually pull this off?
Right. Allison, your first?
Yeah, I had been interested after the press coverage and just seeing the really beautiful photos of the set. I didn't really know what to expect, but I made 2 of my friends go with me. And when I went, I'm still kind of shocked how much I managed to see the first time.
So I think you were lucky.
I think I was just like, I don't know, running around frantically.
There are some background noises.
Because when I went my first time, I think I saw Macbeth maybe once or twice, and I saw 0 murder scenes.
Yeah, I
and a friend who that happened to.
I think I just had a really lucky experience. Yeah,
I had a very uneven first night at the show, actually, and I remember I would hear this loud techno playing somewhere. I was probably up on the 5th floor. I was like, where is this coming from? Clearly there's a brainwashing room like in Lost or something, and I just can't find it. So from that first night forward, I had this incredible sense that there's so much more to be discovered.
Well, yeah, and whoever you went with, I'm sure after you went and talked about it after the show, you were like, wow, I didn't see any of the same stuff. What was amazing is afterwards, me and my 2 friends went to a diner and just like talking about everything we'd seen, I realized how dense of a space it was. And so I think I immediately bought a ticket to go back by myself because I thought it was going to close in 2 months, which we know
which,
that it has not.
This illusion they keep pulling, we're closing in 3 weeks, we're closing in 3 weeks, we're closing in a month.
Well, yeah.
I had a similar experience with a coworker because we started arguing. And it turned out he had never been to the 5th floor. And I was like, no, there's another floor. And he's like, no, it's not. I went through the whole space. I went twice. I was like, you didn't take the right flight of stairs that goes like the, like you can try to go a different way, but maybe it doesn't go. So we started talking about what he perceived the order of things to be and what I perceived the order of things to be and realized they were completely opposite.
I think one of the great successes of the show is that there's this kind of mandatory post facto narrative act that you have to go through. You sit down with the people you saw it with and you have to recount what you saw or else it becomes unreal. It's kind of like if you don't talk through the dream you just had, it didn't happen, and you very quickly forget it. And so there's always this amazing experience after the show that people would be sitting there in the bar just trying to take accounting of what they had all seen and fill in blanks where possible and just make it real. And I thought that was, you know, for a wordless production, there's an awful lot of words that come afterwards.
And I mean, that's human instinct, right? Yeah. Because from the cave people, like, we've all, like, everything's about telling stories. And so this is the story of what just happened to me. What is the story of what just happened to you? How do those two mesh? Does this even make sense? Most of the time, that part is what kind of, you know, gets you going and thinking, maybe I should go back.
Right.
And then the third time, okay, I think I got more of the story. Maybe I should go back. And what do you... So there's, like, these little kidnapping scenes? What are you talking about? Right. So I must go back.
Are you trying to connect in part of this, like, overall story every time you go? I'm just curious, because it's not necessarily something everyone does, I think.
Yeah, because I think, like, as part of my daily job, I solve puzzles, I write business rules, I think about flows. Yeah. So for me, I'm like, all right, I think there's a linear story that loops a couple times, but then something, there's a variation on the last one. So my first three or four visits were trying to take the pieces and make sense. Even if the Macbeth thread was the only thread I could put together, it was still one thread that I thought was complete. And then I realized there's 12 simultaneous threads happening.
Yeah, interesting.
It's really difficult to put it together as a story, narrative-wise, but as a logistical or... What's the word I'm looking for? Because there's all these events happening at once.
Right.
And you realize,
you want the master plan. You want the matrix.
But you're kind of putting it together in the fourth dimension rather than putting it together in this linear fashion. It's like, oh, you realize there's a bell that goes off in one place and later a character reacts to that bell in a different way.
Right. You hear the thunder and you're like, wait, what? I heard something and then they all did something in reaction to that.
Right.
I was thinking about that when I went on Tuesday night because I was listening to one of the radios in the space, and you could hear like a blip in the signal, like a certain amount of static that was only for a second, and the barman did something, and I was like, wait, was that like, is it a secret message from Hecate, or is it just like a cue? Like, I was trying to figure out what everyone, like, each character obviously has their own motivations, and you try to solve that, at least based upon what you observe, but you're not always right.
Right. I think a good takeaway, though, is keeping in mind, a lot of people listening might not have been to the show yet, don't struggle to piece it together the first time.
Yeah, I think it's, I went to this thing in London recently called the Dennis Severs House, and this artist started back in the 80s as a big sort of living painting you walk through by yourself and it's lit by candles.
Yeah, that looks
and
really cool.
It's beautiful, and it predates Sleep No More and Punch Drunk by a while. But he left these little notes everywhere that's like, stop looking at objects, stop looking at things, stop trying to figure it out. And I kind of think about that when I'm in Sleep No More too, like stop looking at all the objects and trying to solve it. Just accept that this is an experience as if like going to an art show where there's a message there and there's a tone, there's a theme, but you're letting yourself kind of go in this space. So.
Like you just want to feel it.
Yeah.
My introduction to the show, you know, I was brought up by the house manager of the show, who was a friend of mine. He worked there during the first few months of the run, and he got comp tickets for me and a friend of mine and brought us on opening night. And I remember coming into the show with a limited sense of what it was about. I was promised chasing sexy dancers through the dark in a warehouse for 3 hours and didn't imagine that warehouse to be an intricately detailed set of 100 rooms.
No one told you anything about the connection to Macbeth?
Nope, didn't know anything about the connection to Macbeth. Hadn't read Macbeth to begin with. And I came in and my first hour or so was just looking around and trying to figure out, without even realizing there was characters or any of that going on, and just gradually realizing that there was a loop structure and that there was, you know, clearly a lot more going on. And then by the end of that night, I'd had a door locked in my face. And that's where I realized there were secret things happening, too. And there was so much more to discover and that it would take patience and being deliberate, but also a certain degree of just sort of going with it and letting your attention wander in a sort of more free-form way and just sort of, you know, getting
zen.
Into it. A little bit, yeah, no, and so I think one of the appeals of it is that you can go and every time you're there is a different experience. Your attention is drawn for whatever reason to any set of the stimuli or any of the characters or any particular space, and you know, no two people have the same experience of any given night, and no two nights at that show are ever the same. And I think there's a really wonderful kind of freedom that you feel in that sort of suspended environment that's separate from
the
world.
Well, you also unplug,
yes,
right?
Very
Check your phone, totally. You don't have your bags, you're not on Facebook or Twitter or looking at email.
It's about as unplugged as you can get
yeah,
these days.
There's no talking, there's no photography.
Yeah. And you can't see faces other than the characters, and so you feel this wonderful sense of isolation.
Yeah, and I think that their idea of the masks, there's a lot of site-specific experiences or theater happening right now, but it definitely, you don't have to worry about how the rest of the audience is reacting to it. You're allowed to be completely on your own, even if you're not on your own.
It feels weird to go in an immersive piece and not have the mask on.
Yeah, but it can be, like, this group called the Woodshed Collective did The Tenant up at this old Presbyterian church. I don't know if you all went.
I went. It was West Side.
I thought it was actually really good, and it was free. But definitely, you like were looking at other people's reactions the whole time to the scenes. And the masks they have for Sleep No More are very strange. They're like kind of like skulls, kind of like Venetian masks, kind of
bird like skull.
They're horrible. Yeah, like a plague doctor or something. Yeah. But it, yeah, and it's a bizarre visual, too.
Well, I think I read somewhere where Felix Barrett, the creative director at Punch Drunk, said it makes you like a camera because you can't see, in your peripheral vision.
It's like Bioshock.
they talk about it in, like, film terms when they talk about it. They're thinking totally movie. And in Karina, when I interview, we're going to listen to the interview with Karina in a few minutes, and she said, I think of everybody as being in close-up. Like, I'm always thinking of myself in close-up. And so the actors all kind of think of it that way too. So you are like a wandering camera with behind these eye sockets.
Yeah, you can't see really to your left. You can't see really to your left. You can't see really at all. It's so dark in there. So half the time you're afraid you're going to trip or fall.
I think one of the neat things with the masks is that you do have this set of possibilities with the camera, with your sort of mind's camera, and you can take the wide shot of these large crowd scenes. You can really focus in on a single character's upper, like I did this last night with Macbeth and what he does with his arms in one scene. There's just so many different ways to track it, and it sort of governs your movement through the space as well as you're trying to find certain angles where the lighting, where you see what the lighting director has conceived of for the show. Mm-hmm. That you have these, you know, amazing opportunities to sort of, as you're framing your own experience there, to create a really remarkable visual sense of what you've just done. You kind of film your own movie every time you're there, and you sometimes just find these beautiful, beautiful shots of light cascading through the woods, beaming out of the pagoda.
And sometimes you're in completely the wrong place.
Or sometimes you're in totally the wrong place, standing in front of a light blocking an actor's light, and you feel terrible. It does happen too.
Yeah, sometimes you're the person being lit, and you're like, wait, I shouldn't be. I'm not on stage yet. And the lighting is amazing. I haven't really talked about that much, but the how sometimes you totally don't even perceive it. It's just a nice warm illumination on the dark side because they're trying to slow you down to appreciate it. And then, bam, it just can come out of nowhere, and an actor is suddenly in the spotlight, and this music can swell out of nowhere, and you know, wait, something's happening. I got to go see what's happening.
It strikes me especially in the third floor where the graveyard is and how there's that kind of trick of the light that happens to everyone their first time they're exploring. Mm-hmm. Like, all right, is that a person over there? Why isn't that person moving? And then you realize, wait, that's a statue. But every time I think, for a split second, I'm looking at a person. Mm-hmm. But you're right, like there is a lot of great, it's just all of these elements working together. It's the set design, it's how expressive they are when they're doing these really complicated, you know, dance, I guess, routines. And then there's the lighting. So, you know, when someone's standing in a spotlight and then you hear a thunderclap or the sound of a bell, and it's just, these are all these things that they kind of layer on top
of each other. It's a very detailed, cohesive
experience. The first time you go, you're not really picking up on any of that. Your brain is trying to synthesize what's going on, but it's
so overwhelming.
Really, it's all the senses. And I didn't realize, I mean, it wasn't until the last couple shows where I'm trying to process the sound and how the performers react to it. and I want to say actors sometimes, but they dance a lot, and they're just performers. So how the performers react, and they know every nuance of that soundtrack, and they know exactly how to hit every part of it.
Yeah, every mark. And, yeah. They make their own sound, too, which I've learned. Like, so why is Macbeth throwing himself into this wall? everyone can hear this now.
Yeah, you can hear it. Like, on other floors sometimes you hear things happening.
I think it's interesting. And so, you don't have to use your imagination. It's like a theater experience that excludes the need for your own projections, which is very...
But you bring in all this stuff, because, like, what's happening in this other room? And your imagination does start to run wild a little bit.
I think it's interesting because, we just talked about the masks and this sort of camera operation that you do. At the same time, it's a show that I think says a lot, at least to me, about how privileged the visual often is, and that you have this sort of visual tracking these go through. And then there's the soundtrack on top of it and the rest of the ambient noise, and then there's the textures of the place and the smells, and there are flavors involved, and that it's a show that really does try to incorporate all of the possible sensory stimuli and remind you that it's very possible to communicate a story not just through what you're shown and what you hear, but through all these other senses as well. The way that a character interacts with you, the physicality of their body language, that sort of thing.
Pause for technical difficulties.
Speaking of sounds, what could that sound be? That's kind of like a sound you would hear.
I think you're definitely right, Evan, especially in terms of the floor. Like, when you're walking around the speakeasy, you're walking around the graveyard.
I remember a conversation with a fan who's... I mean, she's been to the show a number of times, and she's blind. She has the most incredibly detailed sense of the textures of every room in the building, and can draw you a map actually of the space. And,
I couldn't draw you a map.
And it's remarkable, how much there is to appeal to senses other than just the sight.
I actually can't go into Hecate's Apothecary because immediately my sinuses are just freaking out because it's so like there's so much dried flowers and herbs and vegetation, because the point of that space is where she like makes all of her potions. And to me, it's almost like it's an anti kind of potion thing for me. I can't go in there because it's too much for me.
Yeah, sometimes I'm walking around like weeks later, and a couple of the prominent scents from Sleep No More come in, and I'm overwhelmed by them. I'm like, it brings me right back to the
show.
Yeah,
it's like a burr that gets in your hair. Something that sticks with you. To steal a Matthew's pole.
Like old dusty carpets.
Right.
Or when something smells damp.
Yeah.
I think there's also certain candles that kind of give a little whiff of Hecate's perfume that a lot of people have kind of gone out and tried to replicate what she smells like.
There's
which is a custom
rose
scent.
It's like a rose with some sort of earthy undertone, but it's a secret example.
And I think for anyone who's seen the show, you certainly you'll have a very different response to chocolate sauce for the rest of your life. There's no way around that.
Yes. So, and candy. Certain unwrapped candies.
Yes.
Be careful of the taxidermist.
Let's talk a little bit about the performers so we can segue beautifully into Karina's interview. Mm. So, how would you describe them? It's sort of part dance troupe, part, they all have very intense acting moments where their faces are under scrutiny at all times, and they have to keep in mind
body language, posture, the way that they kind of, sometimes they'll look at someone in the audience and they'll extend their hand or just whisper something in your ear, but all of them just have presence, like, which is a really hard thing to quantify.
Presence, And they project where they're going to walk before, so people kind of get out of their way. But sometimes they jump backwards and try to, catch people by surprise. You're right there amongst them. And this is something we all take for granted now because we've been a few times. But you're totally there amongst them. And finding your space with them is part of the fun of the show, is figuring out how to be with these performers.
I actually saw some people running away from Hecate earlier this week.
Oh, that's great.
They were like, okay, she's coming towards me. I'm going to scooch over. She's still coming. I'm going to scooch over. I'm going to hide behind my friend.
She can be scary, yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, for the most part, I think the largest share of the performers are trained as dancers, first and foremost. Mm-hmm. Not all of them.
But certainly, and it's funny because I think many of them don't necessarily consider themselves actors, but obviously you've seen the show, there's incredibly,
incredibly demanding
acting tasks in every scene. And there's, be that, you know, in some of the one-on-ones where it is a verbal question finally, but just in terms of their gesture and their expression, there's a huge, it's an incredibly taxing 3-hour, no downtime, no offstage thing. And so I think the performers have an enormous task in front of them, and I think that, you know, they have to, and I think this is also a challenge for the audience, create a sense of empathy and a relationship with a masked audience. And it's incredible how much space there actually is to do that.
It is.
How well they can communicate with you without seeing your full face, and how well you can communicate with them with your eyes and your body.
It's like all the things that their character has internal, they have to take that and turn it kind of 110% all external without talking at all.
Well, I think I read, there's an interview with one of the directors where they said even if they were to cast another Punch Drunk show, they would, that was based on acting and not dance, they would still pick dancers because they're able to express all the way to their fingertips.
Right. They're used to using their whole body. Normal actors aren't.
I think one of the really amazing things about seeing the show is that you quickly realize that you can sort of pick up on those skills as well, and you begin to develop this anticipatory sense of motion. You know where, you can tell where someone intends to go by where they're looking. Your attention really is amplified by it, and you want to start. You sort of, there's clearly a kind of language the cast uses, the stewards inside the show use when helping move people out of, you know, danger areas where your face might get kicked.
There's a little bit of illusion in there too when they start staring at a closed door. You're like, oh wait, someone's gonna come in. Something's gonna happen.
Yeah. And it feels, the first time I was there, it feels very dangerous. There's several fight scenes, but there was a fight scene where I was standing against the wall, and the guy slammed right next to me. Did not look at me. It looked like he had no idea where he was flying.
But he did.
So completely aware. It's amazing. But they don't.
Yeah, they leave you about 4 inches of clearance.
Yeah. And then sometimes they do run right into you, somewhat intentionally, sometimes unintentionally.
Sometimes it just happens.
Sometimes it happens. I've gotten slammed once or twice.
Yeah.
And
it's a dangerous world they live in.
Yeah. Especially for the performers. I'm sure they get hurt occasionally.
It's a physically demanding 3 hours and without a backstage.
Right. So let's listen to Karina's take on this.
All right.
And then we'll come back and commentary about it. Okay, I'm now in the McKittrick Hotel in the historic Mandalay Bar, and any sounds you hear in the background are the actual staff of Sleep No More preparing for this evening's guests to the McKittrick Hotel. And if that's not exciting enough, I am sitting across from the amazing Karina Melia.
Melia.
I'll get that straight by the end of the interview. Thanks for joining us.
No problem.
So, first I want to ask you, we'll have it explained what Sleep No More is already, but I wanted to ask you, how do you explain to casual acquaintances, you know, members of the extended family, that you just happen to run into, what do you do for a living?
I'm an actress, first and foremost, performer in Sleep No More, and, you know, when they say, what's Sleep No More, I say it's a Macbeth Hitchcock mashup that takes place over 6 floors, and it's mostly wordless, so it's all told through movement for the most part. So it's very dance and movement based kind of adaptation. So that's kind of in a nutshell.
So you've started in Boston, 2010,
and
went for
2009
into 2010.
Yep.
Okay, and ran for about six months there.
Yep.
Then you came here, and you've done about a year and 4 months or so.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a long relationship with Punch Drunk, a long productive relationship.
Mm-hmm.
How did you? Where did that start? First of all, how did you first meet with Punch Drunk?
I was finishing my master's at the ART at Harvard. And so in 2009, in the spring, Diane Paulus announced what the next season was, and she had said, we're bringing this British theater company that is doing this Macbeth mashup, and it's dance, and it's in the 30s, and everyone in my class kind of turned towards me like, oh my God, I was like, I need to do this. And I had been studying Macbeth extensively while I was in school, and it's one of my favorite plays, so it was just right up my alley. So they were auditioning at the end of my, when I was finishing my master's, and I auditioned a whole bunch of times for them. I went in originally as a dancer, and it just wasn't my vocabulary or forte. I had danced in my past, but this is, it was just way, not my, yeah, I was not as strong definitely as like some of the dancers were there. So they asked me to come back as a performer. I was like, oh yeah, this is way more my speed. Mm-hmm. And they saw me a bunch of times, and then they kind of specified they were looking for Hecate, and I was like, ooh, this is totally, yeah, this is right up my alley. So, and I went into callbacks for that, and that was that. So I started rehearsals, I think I was the last character kind of added to the cast. I started rehearsals 6 days before we had an audience. Mm-hmm. And then we had an audience, and that was that. And so it was just off and running, you know, at that point. So so that was that, yeah.
And you've played Hecate most of that time.
The whole time.
And you also play another character just occasionally.
I currently started playing the matron, who is the nurse in the woods in the hut. Mm-hmm. And that is a recent development. So I just started playing that role in January. And but up until then, I only did Hecate. I never traded out or didn't do any other roles. So yeah.
And you developed that role, and that was, you were working with Punch Drunk to flesh that out.
Mm-hmm.
So what was that process like? You said you have the background with Macbeth. You've read that a lot, so that came into it. Mm-hmm. But what else?
It was interesting because it was a totally different kind of rehearsal process. Basically, Felix took me through the building, then kind of took me down to the lair. It was in the basement in Boston, the rep bar area. And he said, get used to this space. You're going to spend a lot of time in here. And then asked me to build a one-on-one. And so I was kind of trying to figure out what that was about. And I saw my one-on-one room, and so I started to percolate some ideas. And then one of the punch-drunk British cast members, I asked him, like, am I doing this right? And I don't know exactly what this is. And so he played Malcolm. His name is Hector Harkness. He was the original Malcolm. And he said, come with me, I'll show you my Malcolm one-on-one. And I said, oh, okay. So he did the one-on-one for me. And then I went, okay. That's what this is. Of course, I was, like, building some epic, you know? And I was like, oh, it can be just kind of refined down into this little thing. So we just worked on it and tweaked it, and Felix would come and see where I was with the work, and I would show him, and we would tweak it, and then it was like, here we go, we got an audience. And then we started running the loops, and once you start running the loops, you see what characters kind of come through your path, and you kind of create what exchange that will be like, or what you guys want to do, and again, they'll come down, Maxine and Felix, and they'll work with you and tweak it, and then, you know, you just flesh it out. And so,
Maxine and Felix, the producer and the choreographer.
The choreographer and the director,
director.
And then you kind of trial by fire, and then you have the masks in the room, and that's really when you start to be able to kind of play and really see what the traffic is like, how they respond, how close people are getting to you. And it's really very much kind of stylized, but also very cinematic kind of acting in terms of, you know, you can really be very small and just kind of think the thoughts and just kind of feel like you're in close up almost the whole time. You almost have to think that way. Because you don't have to project to the back, you know, of a 500-seat theater.
Right.
So it's a different kind of way of working. But I love it. You know, kind of marries that kind of film acting with theater, which is.
Did you watch a lot of the period film that they were pulling from when they were getting inspiration for this?
So I had seen some Hitchcock, and I was familiar with the Hitchcock. I'm not incredibly familiar with Rebecca. Vertigo I know very well. I had seen a lot of kind of period films because I had actually the play before. At ART, I had done when I was, right before I graduated, I played a 40s-esque movie star, kind of bitchy movie star. So I had watched a lot of those, like Bette Davis and Jean Harlow and Rita Hayworth movies, so I kind of had that already in my system. So I really kind of was like, oh yeah, okay, like the movements and all those little poses and the way they kind of walk. And so I kind of got to work with that again and instill that into the whole Hecate vibe. And then the costume came along and that really influenced
the
everything.
The costume makes a big part of it.
Oh
right?
Yeah. You have a tail, you know? Pretty much, you have a tail to work with.
That's quite a dress. I accidentally stepped on it once, so you just kept on.
Oh, yeah.
It didn't stop anything.
It's a tank. That dress is a tank.
Did you watch any David Lynch, by any chance? While you were...
Yeah, Mulholland Drive.
Mulholland Drive.
That one I watched. Jacob's Ladder was another one I watched. That was pretty much it. A little bit of Blue Velvet. But yeah, there's a lot of different influences in the show.
So your experience in the performance, so you have a little more leeway than many of the actors to interact and to pull people in.
Mm-hmm.
And your character can actually see people almost all the time, basically.
Mm-hmm.
So what is your experience when you're in the show? How do you know where your points are? How do you know what the timing is?
It varies. You know, I think... you know, sound, and you get to know the building so well too that you can almost know and hear other characters passing close by to you or something that's happening upstairs, and you're like, oh, that's happening, now it's time for me to do this. Yeah, music, sound, other characters, everyone has different things that they kind of go off of. But you just get to know your timing so well. It's just clockwork, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's just... Yeah, there's a lot of different ways to kind of go, oh, this is where I need to be now, and this is where I need to be now, and
So how does the music play during a given scene? Does the music, or even the sound, there's a little like, thunder rolling in the background sometimes, and is that something you play off of, or you just have you sort of know it now so well that you can...
Mm-hmm. You start to learn all those little, tiny little, like, you know, and then you start to play with what you can maybe do on that, or the thunderclap, or you know, hearing someone down the hall and how you respond to it, and but you get to know the soundtrack very, very, very well, and then you get to kind of play with that and have it kind of enhance what you're doing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, just that kind of the drone-y soundtrack that's kind of in between the musical kind of soundtrack. You start to, it sounds very kind of vague, but you really start to pick out like the tiny little tweaks in there that you can kind of pick out and, so yeah.
Neat.
Yeah.
So your audience is surrounding you and they're all wearing masks and you're trying to connect with them. And you do a very good job of connecting with them, but how exactly do you do that? How do you feel like you're pulling people in?
Oh God, a lot of it is just timing. A lot of it is just get a sense of someone being with you and focused, or just, you know, if they're engaged or they've maybe want to be someone. You just start to kind of feel it out. You start to kind of know people's body language very well. You can tell who's engaging with you, and you can tell who kind of isn't, even with the masks on. You can just start to kind of really gauge that. So that can definitely influence, you know, who you focus on or give attention to or reward with, you know, or one-on-one or whatever. You know, there's a lot of different ways to go
different
about it.
Interactions.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So how about eye contact? Is that something that the director's focused on? Because I've noticed that eye contact seems to be a very important way that all the performers gauge how they're with the person.
Yeah, I mean, you can definitely, even with the mask on, that's your kind of point of contact from across the room or walking up to someone or, and you can choose, you know, when to make eye contact and when not to make eye contact and kind of, you know, feel it out. But when you do make eye contact in this world, it's very potent, so you can't be very haphazard about it. And so it's very pointed and very kind of focused, and you know, your gaze is very powerful in this work, so making eye contact with someone has a lot of significance. So, you know, not to throw it away kind of thing, to really kind of give it some weight. So yeah, that's definitely important. And you can tell the impact it has when you really, you know, you focus on someone and you look at them and you're going towards them and you see their eyes get bigger and bigger and you're like, I'm looking at you, you know. So it's definitely very potent, you know, mm-hmm. potent tool.
You're an expert practitioner, I have to say, of the eye contact, of the gaze. I remember one time I walked into your area and I saw you were sitting down having a meal,
mm-hmm.
and there were about 20 people around you, and yeah. but you looked up, and it seemed like you were looking up at me and bringing me in. I might have been 15, 20 feet away,
yeah, yeah.
but it pulled me into that scene.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I might have just passed right on through
uh-huh.
otherwise.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's one of those scenes that it's all about the eye contact, for sure.
Is there a specific response you're hoping to get out of a guest at any particular time, or...?
Not really. Not because everyone's going to react differently that you never know. Mm-hmm. So you just don't know. You know, you hope people are engaged and focused. Mm-hmm. But people react in all sorts of ways, and you just have to kind of go with it, which makes, you know, every performance a different experience.
Mm-hmm.
Because you just don't know what you're going to come across. And, you know, the audience are your scene partners in a lot of these kind of scenes and situations. So, so you just kind of have to roll with it, you know? So it's fun. It's a lot of fun.
I read an interview with some of the other performers, and they described the experience of rehearsing and being a part of the show. It's highly engrossing.
Mm.
It's overlapping with their own lives.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you transition? How do you cross between here and...
And real life.
Yeah.
I don't know. I guess you just... I don't know. You definitely, you take it into the outside world. You just start to be really observant of people's body language, or just even the grocery store, what, you know, what people's traffic patterns are like, and how you're going to get through them, and you know, it is really interesting because, you know, even small little moments on the streets, you know, we have a lot of these small moments in the show. You start to go, wow, that's like a. If you came across that in the show, like, people are really, you know, engrossed in that, but it's the day-to-day stuff that happens within the show that you start to notice on the outside world, and you're like, oh, wow, this little moment when someone's, like, trying to pick out, you know, I don't know, a box of cereal. Whereas people would watch that in here and go, what's going on, what's going on? And in the outside world, you just start to pick up on these tiny little nuances of everyday life that are part of this world, too. So it's interesting. It is interesting.
I think a lot of the guests report the same thing after mm-hmm. they've spent
mm-hmm.
time in here. They mm-hmm. leave and they're watching people walking
in a new way,
they,
yeah,
right.
in a different perspective. And you
right.
see the non-linearness of your day-to-day life, you know, that crossing a path with someone on the sidewalk and
hello,
where they're coming from and where they're going.
Are we all having a beautiful day?
It's all right.
It's okay. Where they're going, where you're going, how you're intersecting them. And, you know, it's this is kind of a little... capsule of that, so mm-hmm. yeah, you definitely start to notice that in the outside.
There's no little transition, little prayer you say before you go between here and the
outside. No, you just kind of jump out.
Head out there and
just go.
So rehearsal is continuing all the time? Is that something that...
Well, as we get new people into the show, they rehearse, yeah.
That's mainly
yeah.
to incorporate new people. It's
yeah.
not
yeah.
You don't really have to refine at this point. You've got it, and you...
Yeah, yeah. And you just learn and new things within the show, too. It grows mm-hmm. and expands kind of on its own. As you get to know the world better and your exchanges and your scenes better, you start to find little tiny things, and it becomes richer and richer and richer as time goes on. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And there's a little MIT experiment that
mm-hmm.
you did,
mm-hmm.
and... maybe there'll be other experiments in the future you guys are
hopefully
working on?
Hopefully. We'll see. You know, the show just kind of expands. It's its own kind of animal in a lot of ways. So, you know, it definitely, over the course of time, it does get richer and it does get kind of fuller and thicker. I guess Maxine likes to say the show gets thicker and thicker and thicker.
Thicker.
Mm-hmm. And you can feel that.
People can follow you on Twitter.
Yes.
Do we want to encourage that?
If you want,
sure.
You can. I'm pretty boring. Sure.
It's fun.
Yeah.
It's a fun way to
Yeah, interact. Just Karine Amelia at Twitter. Yeah.
Well, great. Well, thank you. It's been a wonderful run you guys are having, and I hope it continues. You really do create magic every night.
It's a fun show.
And I hope it continues as long as you'd like to be a part of it.
Thank you. Yeah. Yeah, it's fun.
And thanks for taking time out before your performance.
No problem.
Have fun tonight.
Thank you.
So Karina's a sweetheart. We adore her.
That was.
She's the best,
right? We all love Karina. You all told me before I went, like, oh, Karina, she's great. You know, and of course she was really wonderful. And
it's the
really
opposite of the character she plays.
Kind heart, yeah. Yeah, if you
the
just know her.
Conniving,
Hecate.
Manipulative.
So a couple things right off the bat from that interview we should explain. One is, it's funny, we recorded that in the bar, and here we are right next to a bar here, so you're getting a sort of a similar, well, seamless experience.
Yeah, Bernard Chouinard is on top of a
totally,
bar.
Yeah.
Well, you know, that's
totally
one of the key elements of all their shows, is they're always a bar.
There's always a bar.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They've been doing this for, 10 years?
I think Felix Barrett loves a good bar, particularly a good dive bar, so,
And the other
little
thing,
cabaret.
Because I want people to understand what a loop is, because she just sort of throws in that they run the loops. So the show is a one-hour loop played three times.
Kind of
more or less,
right.
Yeah.
It's a minor variation, but mostly, you know, you will come in, and whenever you enter, the show will be in progress, and you can follow that through, and eventually the action begins to repeat. But it
has an ending. Yeah. Does it really have a beginning?
No, it's like a dream. You don't remember when you fall asleep.
Right, right. And the ending is
ding,
sort
ding,
of...
Ding, ding, Allison wins.
The ending, to me, feels... It's a little forced. I think they just feel like we have to have an ending, and it's a very obvious ending. It's not really forced, but it's like they don't want it to end, really, but they know it has to end.
Mm. Well, they tried that open-ended thing, I think, with the previous production I was reading, and the show would be over when the last audience member left, and someone stayed for, I think, 12 hours, and they're like, this is going to wear our cast down to nothing.
Yeah, that doesn't exactly work. So they had to have some official, okay, this is, we're leaving now.
Yeah, it's more logistical.
You know, their end of the story doesn't have a beginning point, but yours does. You enter into the space through this dark maze that is...
terrifying.
Kind
the
of the opening
time.
Titles of a film, there's sort of an overture playing, but it's also you're falling asleep, you become disoriented, and then when you get through, you're in this hazy, red, beautiful.
You emerge
you've
into
emerged,
this. Yeah.
And you're already in the show at that point. There are characters who greet you, and you interact with them as though you're in their life instead of your own. And so that's where you've been lulled to sleep, and you're in a dream already. You don't remember exactly how it happened and what the break
but
was.
But somehow you've met Violet and Maximilian, and they're telling you about the hotel. And
Violet and Maximilian are the character actors in the bar who you run into. So the experience starts with the bar. And it's such a simple thing they do. They take you through this little dark passage and then unveil this thing. And everybody I brought through, they've said... the people I brought through have been designers and managers of the Scare House. And they've said, this is already cool. I'm already in this.
Well, you know, some people turn away.
And some
they
people,
turn around.
Some people are, because it's the scariest.
Some people
part,
are very, very actually. Terrified by that.
Like,
minions.
They leave the show.
My wife clenched my hand there, and I was like, okay, we'll get through this.
Did you get stuck?
And we didn't get
I got stuck my first time behind a bunch of people who were, like, just feeling their way around and screaming, like,
I thought they usually stagger it so you kind of end up alone.
I ended up in a clump.
It is, but like you say, it is a very simple thing, and nothing in Sleep No More is very complicated. It's like old objects, like a, I don't know, like Joseph Cornell assemblage.
Right, his boxes.
Yeah, and it's like nothing is very complicated, but all these very simple,
it's all
but
the
very
right
well
things.
Thought out things are coming together. So, and the tunnel's a perfect example. It's just a dark tunnel, but with the Bernard Herrmann music, who might as well be another
blasting,
character.
Yeah. So loud. Yeah. You can't hear yourself think. You kind of see other people, but not really. You see light flickering every once in a while.
Yeah, it's something that's an element of the show that after 28 performances, I still enjoy every time.
It doesn't get old.
Maze, is it feels it you because you know you're arriving into something and you don't know what's on the other side of it. Do you listen par? And then God knows what will happen to you after that. What your reception will be like, what you will see, and so it's this wonderful moment of anticipation going through that every time.
And then there is the bar, which is now a public space that you can enter
music.
When the show is not. Yeah, and there's live music. And Scott, who the manager at Scare House, I brought him there. And just as soon as he was in there and sitting down having a drink, he was like, I could live here. This is
does
good.
Does the Scare House have a bar?
It's a speakeasy. No. There's no liquor license. Boy, I'm sure they would love to have a bar because
And then you look around and there's, you know, the... all these like candles and red, everything feels very cushy, and then there's a handful of cast members dressed in beautiful gowns and tuxedos, and you know, Maximilian, come, my dears. I'm calling all of the aces. Just put your drinks down and follow me.
Right. You don't have too much time to get totally soused, which I think also helps.
It's a good thing.
Yeah.
The show, that some of the worst audience members at the Scarehouse are people who show up drunk, and they get pretty grabby at some of the actors.
How do you enter people into, like, because I don't go to a lot of
haunted houses,
we can mention that. And, like, how do you start people out in, like, something else? Because I think that they do it so well here, but it's...
There's some similarities, which we're not... It's not that similar to Haunted House, but Sleep No More and Haunted Houses are very different animals. But, so there's a big line outside in front of the Scare House, and sometimes it could take an hour or more to get in, and that gets people kind of scared and psyched out. And then they get inside, and there's a lobby showing B-movie trailers, which kind of gets them excited. And there's some atmosphere in there. There are character actors who are walking around. There's, like, this guy in a dirty bunny suit who looks like a pretty scary guy. And
sounds terrifying.
Yeah.
Yeah. Donnie Darko-esque.
Right.
Yeah. The Scare House Bunny has a Twitter feed. So it's popular. So so that happens. And then you have people at the entryway explaining to you the rules. In this case, the rules are don't touch the actors and they won't touch you, which is totally not the rules in Sleep No More. That's right. A difference. They don't mention that at all, and totally they can touch you in Sleep No More. And, but you don't know that at first, and you don't really touch them. It's something they initiate, and they negotiate that so well. It's amazing. And you start down this sort of dark passage, and there's music and sound, and then you're in it. And then right away, I mean, the differences are the two experiences totally diverge, because there are severed heads and clowns and
really
scary. They try to hit you and scare you right off the bat. And Sleep No More, it's more of a thriller. It's a slow, simmering,
it's like this
creepiness.
Unease throughout the whole space.
Right.
You feel like you're a little bit on edge, but no one's going to grab you and yell in your face.
Right.
Well, I love you're standing outside, and then when you finally enter, there's a long, dark tunnel, and then they give you your room key.
Mm-hmm.
And then from then on, you're kind of in their hands, and you go through the maze, and you're like, oh, well, my room key says 2, his room key says 3. I guess I'll see you later.
Right. Yeah, they've done the thing recently. So, yeah, so the room keys are the way that they bring you into the show.
It's actually a playing card.
Right, yeah. It's a playing card, and that's how they get people into the show, through an elevator, and they just call numbers. And lately they've been trying to separate couples. If you're there with a couple, they try to give you a different number.
Well, that's been their thing from this. I got separated in the beginning.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Early on. So I guess I noticed that they pegged me as a couple.
And a lot of the characters do that. I've been standing next to people holding hands, and the taxidermist will grab the girl, and I watched one of them almost shut the door on the boyfriend's hand because he did not want to let go, and the woman was freaking out. And I'm like, just let yourself go, honey. Just say goodbye. You'll be fine.
Yeah, that's one of the it's not a rule, but it's a piece of advice they give, that the show is best experienced alone. And I think what's interesting to see that audiences, I think, struggle with trusting them on that point.
Mm-hmm.
And it clearly is best done that way. But it's interesting when it's put forward as a challenge to an audience. No. You're used to coming to movies and plays and such, and sitting with your friends and being able to sort of, you know, chit-chat.
You can't
talk.
But
here it's different. You can't talk. And so, really,
what's the point?
Why would you need to be with anyone? You'll just want to follow your own camera and your own instincts and let that sort of guide you. And
don't daisy chain yourself.
And remind yourself
that
it's impossible to see everything in that space in a given night. So you don't try, and you do your own thing, and then you know, someone else sees something different, and that's okay, and that's how you actually cover the whole thing.
I should also say that my wife, who's definitely, she does not want to go into haunted houses ever. She's one of those people who freezes, and you can't push her forward. So the first time we went, she was like, okay, just don't leave me alone. But she found a comfort zone with it. And last time she was completely on her own, and she did fine with it. So it's not the kind of thing, if you're terrified of haunted houses, you should be able to get through this okay. You realize that you're pretty
well.
You're
in control still.
You're in control, and you're being well taken care of, really. It feels dangerous, it feels scary, but you're actually being very well taken care
of. Yeah, I feel like, you know, there's clearly in a haunted house, I think the point is to terrify and overwhelm and to horrify. And sort of, whereas in Sleep No More, it's to mystify and to tantalize and to, you know, kind of titillate also. It's just it's done with suggestion and with nuance and
surrealism.
And surrealism and great control and real precision on the part of the performers and the production crew to create a very detailed, you know, immersive experience for you where you everything else shuts off and you're just in this this world.
There are no clowns, there's no dirty bunny, and there's nobody with a chainsaw.
Well, there was a clown singing at the bar last week, who's apparently amazing.
That was the one time deal.
That's just the aftermath. That's not in the show.
No, they did have a Halloween show where like people were encouraged to dress.
One of the Halloween theme nights was a scary costume.
I loved though one guy had worn a cloak, so when he put on the mask, he looked just like an Eyes Wide Shut, where the mask, like the guy in the balcony with that Sleep No More mouse, someone dressed like that so that he had it was very clever. Exactly, yeah.
Let's see, one more thing I wanted to bring up. So getting comfortable with following a performer is something that they give you no instruction about this going in. So you have to find your own zone and feel that out as you go. And I think it took me a couple shows before I was comfortable really following someone around. I felt like I was stalking them. And they're totally used to that, and they probably enjoy it when someone follows them for room to room and is really enjoying their performance. They probably don't like it when they're constantly being bumped into and stepped on. So how did you find your comfort zone, and how do you...
You sort of pick up from watching them sort of what their range of reaction is. So I think, you know, with Hecate, with Karina's characters, got a little more space because she has this really long train on her breast. So you gotta give her some space to swing that thing. Others you can get quite close to, but you sort of have to, like, watch them and see how broadly they move, I guess, and you pick that up, and I think if you're someone like me, comes in with no dance background, that thinking about that kind of movement and physicality is very new. I think if you come in as a performer, it may be quite a little bit more intuitive, but for most people, you don't really pay much attention to physical space and the power of it and what someone's normal range of operation is, and you do that at Sleep No More, and you can get quite close to the characters, but you definitely don't want to be like the one who's not paying attention and stumbles into them in the stairwell, because that's awkward.
And I think whatever character you decide you're going to stick with for a little while, you probably already feel some sort of connections, maybe you're on the same sort of wavelength anyway.
So your proximity becomes a way to show your empathy with them, but it also, you have to self-manage that. So it's like, I really care about your story, so of course I'm right on top of you. It's, I care about your story, so I'm close enough to get it all and let you know that I'm here with you and want to help you if I can, but I also know that you have a story you've got to tell, and I keep a certain distance so you can do that and to do your performance, and that other people around you can still enjoy it too, and not have this person stalking over a character everyone's trying to look at.
It depends who you're talking about, who you're following, the air that they give off.
And I saw last night, there are definitely people who are following performers very closely in hopes of getting some sort of reward. They interact, find different ways to interact. The ultimate is getting pulled into a one-on-one, which we won't talk much about, but that happens, these private performances. But people follow sometimes very closely, and if you get too up in their grill, so to speak, they kind of will find ways to reject that or maybe pass you over.
The show, definitely the performers, and there's, like we were talking earlier about this sort of physical language, there are ways to make clear that you're too close, and you can do it very gently and very calmly. And audience members, I notice, will sometimes do this with each other, where they just sort of have this gentle tap that helps people know I need a little more space here.
How do you silently say excuse me?
It's really kind of exciting because it builds this community in the audience where people are like, okay, let's quickly self-regulate so we can all see the scene together.
Self-regulation,
And that has impressed me, because that sense, I think, has grown actually as the show has gone on, and more of the audience is returning audience members, that they've learned to sort of operate within those constraints and with each other.
And people get enthused and excited, and they jump forward and they bump into somebody, but then they quickly say, oh, I'm sorry, I'm just getting excited,
Although I was following the porter, and the porter went back into his office, and there were three guys in there rifling through all his things and clanging around. I don't know what they were doing, that it was like you could hear the clanging. And I cleared my throat, and the guy put everything back, and he was like, sorry, 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 man. And then I tapped it, and I was like, wow.
It's good to be enthusiastic, but you know, you gotta be reined in sometime.
Yeah.
All right, so I guess we're getting a little more into the level of a little more spoilery. We're keeping it spoiler light, but I'm going to have a little warning in here about where the more spoilery things are, because the best way, I think, to experience it the first time is to know as little as possible.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So, all that in mind, I'd like you
to... I mean, somewhat blind, I find it helpful to tell people that, at a minimum, be prepared to run.
Be prepared to run.
Follow someone if you think they're interesting.
Right.
It does go in a loop, so don't think you're insane that you've seen the same thing twice.
Right. Good stuff to know, yeah. So all that in mind, I'd like to ask each of you, if you can, your favorite experience or moment in the performance, in the show, the experience, and your maybe a favorite character or performer, stuff along those lines. I'll give you a chance to think. I was thinking today how I would answer this, and I think if I'm a collector of anything in the show, I love the interrogation scene. And to see how there's always two different guys interrogating each other, and it's, once you know when it happens, it's in the realm of the possible to see it at least once a night. So it's, you can catch it, you're usually there with
eight other people, maybe?
Yeah, eight or less usually. One time I was in there, it was like, totally packed.
Yeah.
Last night there was maybe six.
It's this tiny, skinny room.
I think I've been in there more than three people. It's interesting.
Yeah, and sometimes some people reported it being alone.
Yep, people have been alone. I usually get crushed against the back wall, and I'm usually... That scene, I'm just unlucky, and the mountain that walks is in front of me, this
right,
six foot eight man, and I'm, you know, 5'8". I'm just like, well, so much for seeing this scene. Glad I'm in here.
So for the people listening, it's a very narrow room, and it's only unlocked during specific times, with the scene being one of them.
But it's some of the most remarkable choreography in the entire show that happens there. And incredibly difficult in a dark room.
Two guys fighting, and they're throwing this lamp around, and you kind of watch it towards your face and think to yourself, I'm going to get hit.
Right. It's another one of those dangerously feeling things. You don't know how they manage to do it every night without injuring each other or somebody in the audience. But
they probably injure each other.
People
once
have been hit.
Yes.
Yeah, do you notice they, like, I mean, some of the actors have, like, bruises on their legs. And
you
that.
See, like, a wrap on an ankle or something.
Yeah.
The performance takes its toll on them.
Oh, favorite scenes. Oh, this is incredible.
It's really difficult.
I bought you some time there.
Yeah, no, I think one of the things is that your favorite scenes will change, obviously.
Yeah,
keep going back.
Each time you see something new, you're like, oh my gosh, how did I miss this before?
Yeah, I guess, like, where we've been all a lot of times, what it might be, like, what scene do you find yourself drawn back to? It's like, now we're sort of playing this, like, album we really like, but there are certain tracks that you still want to come back to.
Oh, that's a great way.
Or, like, a movie, you're just kind of flipping through, and you're like, oh, I have to watch the rest of this now.
Yeah.
There's no way I can pull myself away.
But we also, it's awesome that you get to see all these different people interpret it. I think, maybe because I'm sort of a creepy person who stalks around cemeteries herself and has bones in her apartment, but I'm really drawn to the taxidermist and just the different ways it's played. Like, it can be, if for people who haven't gone, it's like, there's a few characters that have sort of shops in this town, and there's a taxidermy shop, but it's an odd one where I don't know if the taxidermist really knows what he's doing. The very strange creation,
kind of
sort of
impossible,
like a Frankenstein.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Impossible creatures, but where you're like, that skeleton's not right.
Yeah, it can be played as like alluring, or is like very creepy or sinister, and it's
menacing.
It's not an integral character to the show, but if you've ever been involved in any sort of fandom, you know that the most popular characters are probably the least central. So, because you get to kind of it's like you don't even have to. It's not important to the show, but it adds. If you're talking about Sleep No More being like an unsettling experience. He's also the elevator operator. Mm-hmm. So,
spoilers.
It's
a spoiler.
Yeah, I guess. spoiler.
But he is kind of, because he's part of the town, and this whole town is kind of in Hecate's thrall, except for a couple of the characters. Like, that is its own, almost its own tapestry of well, he's in cahoots with the, and then there's the witch, and then there's the bartender. Well, whose side is he on, really, and what's going on?
I guess, but I'm never one of the people who's trying to figure out the narrative. So I, perhaps that's also, right. Like well, yeah, I know
the
it's
the whole
happening.
Subplot about Agnes's missing sister.
Yeah, it's like, and I'm a writer, so of course I love narrative, but in Sleep No More, I love that I can let myself kind of, like, go into this experience as if it's like
Evan's smiling because he knows where she is.
Like a, yeah,
I do know what happened to Grace.
Yeah,
you'll never tell. End the podcast now.
I should probably be more curious, I suppose, about that. I don't know. It's like
so when a character delivers a locket with someone's face in it or a box that says we have
of course,
her.
I'm definitely curious about all of this, but I don't know. It's interesting. I see these as, like, ghosts who are stuck in the worst moments of their lives going over the same steps in this place that is very haunted and, like, you
so
know,
maybe it's,
course,
like, disconnected vignettes that probably are just, like, little moments?
Yeah, one thing I do miss having gone so many times is being lost in the space. Mm-hmm. Like, it is kind of strange that I know exactly how to get everywhere in a place that... It's not intended at all to be that way.
You can still get lost in it.
Sometimes.
And you still get lost in where you are in the course of the show.
That's true. You can. I did love... they had this night recently. It was the Manhattan Cocktail Classic. And they ended up with half the audience as usual. Mm-hmm. And I don't usually follow Benko because it's so crowded. But I did. And I was totally alone with this character for a cycle. And realized I had no idea that he was doing this... dance just around the corner from something I'd seen before, or that, like, this was happening, and so...
There's little nooks you can ignore.
Yeah, and it's fascinating that something can be happening around the corner, and you make these connections. Yeah, I shouldn't disregard the narrative at all, because, like, I made that sound like I just don't care. I guess I just, I like how liberated it is from... sequential storytelling in the same way that, like we're in a gallery right now with these very visceral paintings, and, like, I don't know what the story is there, but there's definitely, like, a narrative. So, like, narrative without story, if that makes sense.
It's linear for the people who are playing the characters in the loop, but each audience member is kind of, you know, weaving their own experience, so it's nonlinear for you if you choose to just kind of wander.
It's always nonlinear, I think, because...
Because you don't follow people for the whole hour.
There's also not necessarily causal sequence.
Like
cause and effect is difficult.
Yeah. I don't know.
It's elusive.
I don't know where I'm going with this. I guess.
It is. It's really hard to put together. It's very hard to write about. We've all struggled writing about it. And I was trying to write this somewhat scholarly essay about it, and getting the facts straight and putting together. Treating it as a text is very difficult.
Yeah, because it's much more about an experience of senses than your brain, really. I don't know.
Right, right. They always describe it as experience, first and foremost.
Yeah, it's spatially and temporally confined, and so, you know, you can talk about it afterwards, but it's very hard.
And do you trust your own memory?
Right, do you trust your memory? And, you know, obviously yours is a unique experience, and so really what happens in the McKittrick Hotel stays in the McKittrick Hotel to a certain degree.
Unless it's on Tumblr,
in keeping with its name, it is its own universe, and I think that's one of the most amazing things about it. That, you know, for as much as there's not much of a fourth wall there, that it has a very well-defined external boundary. For once you're into it, it becomes a thing that, you know, is sort of a self-operating, self-regulating world.
But it affects your brain.
It does affect your brain. You definitely see yourself walking through your day differently as a result of it.
Totally.
Favorites. We're still in favorites.
I don't think that I really even answered that question.
Oh, yeah. We didn't go to favorite moment or character. You don't have to.
Well, because you'll see something and it'll become your favorite then.
Taxidermist, that was my favorite.
I've just finished a couple weeks of really just adoring Lady Macduff. I've had a Porter thing. I have a very long-term Banquo interest. I mean, in terms of favorite scenes, you know, I think we haven't talked much about one-on-ones. These private moments happen. Mm. That is, I think, for me, the emotional crux of the show. That you spend your time anonymous behind a mask, and then some certain scene happens where that mask comes off, and you go from feeling incredibly secure in your anonymity to extraordinarily vulnerable. And so I think those moments, I think, make you very acutely aware of your vulnerability and your sort of responsibility to be an, you know, an empathic, you know, empathetic audience member at that point. And that a character is really trying to share a very painful story with you, actually. And it's up to you to help. Almost.
It's not always painful,
Help. But like, there's clearly like, there's a very complicated story there, and it's being shared with you and you alone, and sort of it's on you to respond.
And you do
to that
learn. You learn more about the characters. Everybody you realize has this little backstory that they've developed.
Yes.
It was interesting to hear that
very intricately designed characters.
The performers, the early performers, developed. They created those one-on-ones. Because there's just so much material in this show that, that the performers had to create a good bit of it.
Yeah, the performers are, I think, you know, in the one-on-ones, but also just some of the, you know, the other scenes, like, have incredible space to bring their own experience and talents in. And I know that, you know, they've been given that by Punch Drunk, and I think that's why a lot of them like enjoy working there so much, because it really is an opportunity. It's also one of the joys as an audience member that, depending on who's in, you'll see
fascinating reactions between each other.
And just all the incredible creation that goes on either by a single performer or by the groups of them as they have their scenes together. So it's really
The couple, you've had way more conversations with the cast than I have, but just a couple I've had in the conversations I had with Karina, I am amazed how much they enjoy talking about it and about the different aspects of it. They are not sick of it at all. I think they would be sick of it. They are totally not sick of it. They love performing in it, and they know what they're constantly aware of what a gift it is that they are in it, it seems.
Yeah, to the extent that it's an addiction for us as fans, I mean, it's certainly a very similar thing, I think, for them as performers. They're very tightly knit company. Obviously, there's a, you know, an incredible amount of intimacy when you're performing under those circumstances eight times a week.
Right.
You know, and when you've been together as long as I think many of them have, there's an incredible sense of connection among them. And you know, I think for us, it's a real privilege to get to share in that. But then for all of us to get to talk about it afterwards, you know, they certainly, you know, love to have people who have shared what they've been working on for so long, and are into the world as much as they have to be to create it.
Yeah.
I think there's that level of immersion happening too, and it's really, you know, I think for me, for the past 17 months, it's been a real gift to get to know that cast and what they've been doing there, and to see them grow and change things and work on stuff. It's a fascinating process.
Well, there's no applause at the end, so how else do you show your appreciation?
You can't tell anyone thank you. If you're lucky enough, you might get escorted out by a cast member, and they take off your mask. And they may give you a hug or a kiss.
And then they melt away.
And but you have a second there to say thank you. I've done that. I've been able to say thank you right then. It's so gratifying. Now, one thing about speaking to the cat, I'm glad I've had this little experience to do it. I'm conflicted. I'm feeling like I don't want to go any deeper into it because I enjoy so much being on the outside of it. And being totally on the inside of the scare house where I can't get scared or surprised by any of it, and not, I have no idea what the experience is of someone going through the scare house. And one of the general managers was coming through with me, and she's like, she was so excited to go through Sleep No More because she's like, I love the experience of being on this side of it. I haven't done this for so long. And so I think it's enough for me to know that what I was really curious about, do the performers think about such things as, wasn't it coincidence that this happened and then this happened and this happened to me? They really think about that stuff and how cool it is that people are having these experiences. And I think that's a good thing to impart. You have no concept of that when you're going through the show, like how they think about it and what their experience is.
Well, they don't get to go to the show that often either, because they're working so hard.
Yeah, I wonder how often if...
They do get to go see it, but I think, you know, last night, actually, several cast members said to me, like, at this point, you've seen more of the show than I have, and you know it better than I have.
They know their own tracks,
but... they know their own parts, but they don't get to see their coworkers terribly often, you know, because they've got their own things to be doing, so...
Yeah, I wonder if when they go through it, if it's a magical experience for them.
I think it is. Because, you know, and I think it is such a talented group of people that they all feel like... joy of going and seeing what their coworkers do is that you get to see, like, wow, the creative things that the people they work with every day that never see, because they're on opposite ends of a dark hotel, are doing with their character.
Yeah, some of the characters never run into each other. Some of the characters are very isolated. They might interact with one other character, tops, and then the rest of the night, they're alone.
Yeah, I think I was reading an interview somewhere with one of the designers in Sleep No More, and he said the magic is totally gone for him. He wished he could be outside of it. And it's probably because he spent so much time in the space, in placing things, and he's just, with the lights on, and, he's been completely on the other side of it, so...
Yeah, especially if you put together the space, it would be different than if you're just moving through it as, not just, of course, but...
But, like, from a set designer, it's different than a performer.
And I wonder if you took all the performers out of Sleep No More, it would still be a very strange experience to walk around with the sounds and, like, obviously the action and the actors, and I mean, the dancers are so essential to it, but I feel like the space is...
Like, if it was just an installation?
Yeah, the space is really...
It's powerful.
It's the most powerful part of it.
Yep.
So let's wrap this up. So we've kept this on a pretty good, non-spoilery, high level. I might separate some of this out, maybe as a separate thing. We'll see. But just one little Easter egg for the really intense viewers. Let's say the Sleep No More Fraggle Room. Fact or fiction? Catherine.
Wait, which amendment are you supposed to plead again? Is it the fourth or the fifth?
The fifth.
Reveal some sort of real secret. Like, try to think of
something. There are... I don't know how many... Let's see. There's one, two spaces that you have to be let in by a character. At least two.
I don't know. I think that, like...
How many are there? Yeah, we have
that,
to think.
That you simply can't get into? Without, I think
three?
Two.
Well, the sixth floor.
Oh, well, yeah. Okay, so
and then... Gosh. Yeah, there are... I think there's actually several spaces that...
The lair.
Banquo's bedroom.
No, you can go in there. It's open sometimes.
Okay. Lady Macduff's bedroom. Lady Macduff's chapel
is closed all the time.
The hut.
No, the hut sometimes is open.
Yeah.
Occasionally you can look in the hut. Everybody's really curious about looking in the hut. It's a cool little set.
Yeah.
And then there's the other secret
spots. I mean, you'll be wandering around and, a door will open and some people will get a glimpse inside a secret space and then it'll be shut and you may not even know that that space exists.
Yeah. Stay curious, stay bold, and it will reward you.
Sometimes.
I guess it's the best place to end. Well, thank you all for joining me and taking time out and finding your way across town to be here.
All right. Thank you.
Okay, I hope you enjoyed all that. And I should first say that if you have not yet been to the show and you ignored all my warnings about spoilers, you still listened to the whole thing because you couldn't help yourself, I can say... Shame on you. No. I should say, don't worry. You are still in for a great ride. You will still be confused. It'll still be a full sensory overload experience. Nothing can prepare you for that, really. So I hope you go see it. I hope you enjoy it. Drop me a line on Twitter or Facebook and let me know how it went. I'll have links to those from my blog as well. I'd like to thank Catherine, Evan, Allison for meeting with me, and especially Karina and all the folks at Punk Drunk Productions who helped me set up the interview. Thanks also to Allison and everyone at the Recession Art Gallery where she works, who let us use their space for the recording. Recession Art is a beautiful little gallery on Clinton Street in the Lower East Side of New York. Definitely stop in there if you're looking for some affordable art to liven up your life. One more reminder, for all the links made in this episode, you can go to deliriumdog.wordpress.com. This has been the Scarehouse Podcast. You can find more episodes in iTunes or scarehousepodcast.com. Thanks for listening.